You're listening to NPR News 91.1 KNOW Minneapolis St. Paul, discovering what matters.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. At this hour, we are looking at a video feed of a lectern on a stage backed by American flags in Wilmington, Delaware. That is the home city of former Vice President Joe Biden, who this evening is about to give his first speech as President-elect Joe Biden, his first since being declared the winner of the 2020 presidential election earlier today.
As it stands, the AP says Biden has 290 electoral votes, more than enough to meet that 270 threshold. And President Trump has 214, but the president has yet to concede, even as we await remarks from President-elect Biden.
And we should mention there is a warm-up speaker of sorts. The Vice President-elect Kamala Harris is also expected to give brief remarks tonight, followed by the president-elect. And as we await those remarks any moment now, we are going to continue bringing you analysis from our NPR correspondents who have covered this entire unprecedented presidential campaign.
And we're going to go first to our colleagues who are covering the Biden campaign. They are both in Wilmington, Delaware, where, as you just heard, President-elect Biden is expected to speak from. Scott Detrow is NPR political correspondent, and Asma Khalid is also an NPR political correspondent. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being with us through this long, long couple of days, months, weeks. I forget. What is it? What is it? A long
right,
time.
Years, in the last
years
few
for
days,
these guys. Yeah.
Or hours or what?
Good evening.
So you both have reported extensively on Joe Biden and the messages that he delivers to voters, his long history, his story, how he connects with people. So we're going to ask each of you, what do you think his message will be to the nation this evening as president-elect? Asma, why don't you start?
Well, I would say if we've gotten any indication of what it might be, both from the statement that he offered earlier today and then even here in Wilmington from some of the introductory videos that they've shown, it's a message of unity, healing. Joe Biden has pitched himself, often as saying, I'm running as a Democrat, but I will be a president for all Americans. And that is the message that was the through line throughout much of his campaign. You know, I anticipate that we'll hear some of that. We've been hearing that similar theme, in fact, all week long, even as votes and ballots were still being counted.
Scott Detrow, why don't you pick up the thread there and add whatever you'd like to add to that? And I also want to ask you to reflect on, you know, this is a long time coming for President-elect Biden, his third presidential run over three decades. So tell us a bit more about what you expect to hear from him tonight and what stands out to you from the arc of his political career.
Sure. I do expect a lot about unity, a lot about the ability to get things done. He has repeated in the last few weeks, the closing weeks of the campaign, something along the lines of America made a choice to become as polarized and gridlocked as we are, and we can choose to move forward. And of course, he will have a quick chance to put his money where his mouth is if, in fact, he takes office with a Republican-controlled Senate. In order to get anything done, he will need to reach across the aisle, as he's promised. So that's that on the message. And in terms of just the arc of Joe Biden's career, I keep coming back to the fact that he is the oldest person ever elected president, and at the same time, he is the youngest U.S. senator in American history, or one of them at least. He didn't turn 30 until after he was elected to the Senate for the first time in 1972. He has spent nearly half a century in the federal government, working in the system as a senator, as a chairman of key committees, as the vice president of the United States. And he is ousting the first person who never held elected office or military office to hold the office of the presidency. And it's almost a polar opposite approach. Well, Donald Trump was a norm breaker, Joe Biden is a norm respecter and lover of norms of such, to the point of frustration at times throughout the year of his progressive base. So I think it's a commitment to governing and a commitment to tradition that we will hear tonight and in the coming weeks.
Asma, if you're still with us, I can hear that there's a little bit of a little instability on your line there. But if you're still with us, we are also going to be hearing from Kamala Harris, who's said to be the nation's first ever woman vice president. She's certainly the nation's first black vice president. She's the first woman of South Asian descent to be vice president. We know that part of it. What's been her role in this campaign, and what do you think her role will be in a Biden administration?
You know, I'm really interested to better understand, in fact, what her role is in a Biden administration. in part because Joe Biden himself, as many Democrats, even frankly, who voted and supported him, said he is 77 years old. He will be 78 upon inauguration. And so amongst many Democrats, there has been this concern even about his age and frankly, whether or not he would even seek a second term. So I anticipate that we will see more of a governing role from Kamala Harris. You know, both she and Biden have said that they intend to have a relationship akin to the relationship that Biden had with former President Barack Obama, meaning that she is the last one in the room when he's making big decisions. And, you know, certainly I will say they both have a lot of work around the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic recession around governing, frankly, even before they take office. And they've said that they will begin to attempt to tackle some of those issues.
And I'm sure we're going to hear more about that, perhaps even as early as this evening. But Scott Detrow, what do you think about that? What role do you think Kamala Harris is going to play in this administration?
Biden has insisted that she will be a key partner. Like Asma said, he repeatedly comes back to that last person in the room point. He is obviously somebody who respects the office of the vice president. Many presidents in U.S. history have not had much time for their running mate once the election is over. He has made it clear she will be a key partner. But I'm really curious to see what specific tasks she ends up fronting, because, you know, Joe Biden's most important roles for Barack Obama were to be an emissary to Capitol Hill and an emissary to foreign capitals. And he can do that for himself, obviously. He has a long relationship with so many lawmakers. So I'm curious where Kamala Harris's focus is, you know, in the months after she left the presidential campaign from her own race and the pandemic took hold. She really focused in on not only the coronavirus pandemic, but the fact that it disproportionately affected people of color. That was something she introduced a lot of bills on. She, of course, took a leading role in the Senate when the increased focus on racial justice happened over the summer. I'm curious if those are areas that she will take a leading role.
Steve? I want to mention that the video feed that we're looking at of the lectern in Wilmington, Delaware, the lighting has changed somewhat, as if to suggest that perhaps we will see the vice president-elect shortly. But as we wait, Scott Nasma, I want to ask you if there's time about two steps that lay ahead for the new president, the incoming administration. The first is the transition, which is going to be a little bit shorter, a few days shorter than a president would normally expect to have. What are the challenges that lay immediately ahead for the president and vice president-elect?
Well, I think the top challenge is whether or not the president, the incumbent president, ever concedes at any point. And that certainly plays an overbearing symbolic role. You know, there has the transition by law has been taking place almost effectively for a while now. There have been extensive conversations between teams tapped by Biden and the Trump administration, because federal law lays out this process as soon as there's a nominee. There have not been any reported flags. If President Trump is not conceding the office, that has not trickled down to the transition as of yet. But of course, up until today, this was a hypothetical transition conversation. It'll be very interesting to pay close attention going forward to see if that changes.
Asma Khaled, I want to ask you about the next step for the president-elect, because I've been in on some of your conversations with Scott, and I know you were discussing the very long list of things that Joe Biden on the campaign trail said he was going to do on day one. It's not like there aren't any challenges facing him once he takes office.
Yeah, you know, certainly, and sorry, you might hear a bit of background noise. This is another motorcade is coming in right now here in Wilmington, and there are just quite a few people here who have gathered, frankly, even beyond the security perimeter to cheer on, so apologies, it gets a little loud. But in terms of the agenda that Biden has set forward, I mean, I would say it has developed into a fairly ambitious agenda. You know, during the primaries, there were certainly some of his Democratic opponents who were known more as the policy wonks of the field. But as time went on, you know, Biden added a number of things. He talked about the fact that he intends to set up a task force to deal with family separation. He intends to send a bill, he says, on day one to deal with comprehensive immigration reform. He wants to return to the World Health Organization, re-enter the Paris Climate Accords, you know, rescind the so-called Muslim Plan. The list goes on and on. I think to what Scott had mentioned earlier, though, one of the challenges for Joe Biden, particularly if, in fact, he is dealing with a Republican Congress, are some of these things that he has promised to pledge to deal with that would require congressional approval, say like a comprehensive immigration bill.
Now, stay with us, Scott and Asma, because I want to bring another voice into the conversation. NPR's Tom Bowman has been reporting today from outside the White House, as near as he can get anyway, to Lafayette Square outside the White House. And I'm hearing some sounds where you are, Tom Bowman. What's going on?
Yes, Steve, it's an amazing festive scene here. There are thousands upon thousands of people crammed into the streets around the White House. I'm just across from Lafayette Square. This is mostly a younger crowd, black and white. People are dancing in the streets, setting off fireworks, or a bunch of street performers playing drums. Others are playing music. A few cops I spoke with said everything is really peaceful. There's no trouble at all. And one cop compared it to a World Cup celebration. I would say, Steve, World Cup plus New Year's Eve plus 4th of July plus a World Series win. There are a huge number of flags, American flags, Black Lives Matter, gay pride flags. I saw a massive poster that just went by, said arrest Trump. There are Biden-Harris signs and handmade ones saying one says you're fired, another says adios Trump, another says lock him up, and another says grab him by the ballot. So it's getting more and more raucous as President-elect Biden gets ready to speak.
Tom, I just want to make sure I can identify that crashing sound repeatedly behind you. Is that some kind of gong that we're hearing there?
It looks like someone's smashing cymbals together. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, it is a gong. We also have fireworks going off here. We have a guy went by with a megaphone, kind of talking about Kamala Harris, who, of course, went to school at Howard University. The crowd started cheering. Again, I'm seeing a bunch of people dancing around. I'm looking at the signs. Trump is over. Trump, Pence, out now. Another sign says you're fired. Trump, you're fired. Democracy is saved. Thanks, black voters. And again, it's mostly a younger crowd, as I said, but there are also a lot of parents here with their kids and strollers on bicycles and scooters. And it really is an amazing, amazing celebration and very, very peaceful as well.
I'm glad that you mentioned that last detail, Tom Bowman, because I covered the protests after George Floyd's killing outside the White House, outside Lafayette Square, which, of course, were extremely tense and ultimately led to a moment in which federal authorities assaulted protesters while kind of a surprise attack to push them back, which was very much covered at the time. This sounds like an entirely different kind of atmosphere, and is it safe to say also a very different attitude and approach by whoever may be guarding the White House?
Yes, I think so. Again, I talked to quite a few of the police. They're just really relaxed, hanging back. They're, of course, all around the White House. Some are right on 16th Street at Freedom Plaza. And again, I've never seen police during these times more relaxed than these guys are now. They're saying everything seems great. And again, as I said, one said it's kind of like a World Cup celebration. Everyone is really happy, really excited about what they're seeing.
Okay, well, NPR's Tom Bowman, you're an important correspondent to us. Your ears are important, so guard them against that gong. But thank you very much for the update, and we will just note that there have been reports of celebrations like this in many parts of the country today.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
It's been in many ways a divisive election, but the people who are on the winning side have made their pleasure known.
So let's go to NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro now, who hopefully is in a quieter place than our colleague Tom Bowman. Domenico, good to hear from you.
It's a little quieter in the suburbs.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more. Well, maybe not. I mean, depending on which suburbs. So let's talk a bit more about how things got to this point, you know, if you would. Yeah. For people who are just joining us or for people who haven't been sort of following this in granular detail, you know, you've heard these big celebrations. The one in this was downtown Washington, D.C. We've seen similar celebrations in Atlanta and in New York and in Los Angeles. And of course, there are also people continuing to support President Trump and his quest to hold on to his office, smaller ones, we have to say. But those are going on as well. But how did we get to this point? Talk a little bit more about that, if you would.
Well, you know, it's been a remarkable journey. I mean, just getting to this point, you know, we're seeing record turnout likely. We're already at 148 million ballots that have been counted, and we don't even have all of California in. There's going to be millions more ballots that come in. President Trump and Joe Biden have the top two, are now the top two vote getters in history. 75 million for Joe Biden. He just crossed that threshold. President Trump is at 70.7 million. You know, this has been quite the ride. I mean, the fact is, probably without coronavirus and the amount of mail-in ballots that have been used in this election, you wouldn't have a turnout that's this high. But if you look at states like like Washington State and Colorado, they've always had high participation rates, and they're almost virtually all male. So that's why we're seeing this margin go so high. But, you know, for Joe Biden, somebody who was fifth in New Hampshire, who was really struggling to draw a crowd in Iowa. And I was, you know, right there, a couple events with Asma. I remember talking to her and saying, is every event like this? And the energy just wasn't there with him, you know. But Jim Clyburn, you know, in South Carolina, being able to put his weight behind him and the black community really rising him up, it propelled him. And he became the person to beat. He became the man to beat. And this election, though, you know, while as much good feeling and goodwill as there is toward Joe Biden for the kind of person that he is, for the people who voted for him, this was largely, you know, I'm talking about mail-in votes. The other reason why turnout was so high is just because of President Trump. I mean, people either love him or they really hate him. You know, so he's inspired deep devotion and intense revulsion, as I've said before. And, you know, that drives people to the polls. They just have an intense feeling about which direction this country should go. His supporters, you know, believe that they've been aggrieved and that this president's been standing up for them. And on the other side, you have people who want to have an arc of justice that bends forward, you know, to sort of paraphrase Martin Luther King, the way that Barack Obama always would talk about it. So that's been a very different kind of election that we've seen here, where, you know, a lot of elections, people say this is the most important in history. Mm-hmm. This one really probably was.
Okay, but let me just ask you about that a little bit more, Domenico. You know, mm-hmm. that Rahm Emanuel, former chief of staff, former to President Obama, former mayor of Chicago, famously said, Republicans fall in line, Democrats want to fall in love. Mm-hmm. In this instance, you're saying they didn't ever really fall in love, but they did fall in line, speaking of Democrats now. So what have we learned about the choices that Democrats are willing to make in response to these truly extraordinary circumstances that, frankly, every country in the world, for the most part, is dealing with, which is the coronavirus pandemic, this tremendous economic disruption that has occurred in response to it? I mean, have we learned anything about the way people are willing to sort of order their priorities?
I think
that we didn't already know?
I think President Trump is a unique figure, to put it one way, in American history. And, you know, we were asking that same question during the primaries, because that has always been the thing that people talk about. You know, Republicans fall in line. Mitt Romney was second up and he wound up getting it. But President Trump sort of upended that entire thing. He went with the passion and the feelings and stirred up in people who loved him. And they thought first with their emotion and gut feeling about him. And Democrats were the ones who this time around, they just had such intense feeling of opposition toward President Trump. No matter how many times we asked, no matter how many different ways we asked our reporters to go out on the campaign trail and ask people what are the issues that are important to them, overwhelmingly, Democrats would tell us President Trump just needs to get out of office. That was the number one overwhelming, overarching thing. And they went with the person who they felt was most electable. There were a lot of people who didn't know if that was the smart thing to do because, you know, you might remember in 2004, Democrats did the same thing where they went with John Kerry, feeling like he would be the person who could beat George W. Bush. It's easy to, you know, forget the passion that there was against George W. Bush right in the middle of the Iraq War on the Democratic side. They really desperately wanted Bush out, and they went with the person they thought was most electable, and they lost. This time, they felt, you know, the passion against President Trump was so great that they had to go with the person who they felt could get them over the finish line, and it looks like that worked.
Domenico, because you mentioned the vote totals, I want to raise something that President Trump has said about the vote totals today. He's writing about them on Twitter, and this is the tweet. There's a few things to comment on here. He writes, 71 million legal votes, the most ever for a sitting president. Now, I suppose the first remarkable thing is he's a salesman. He always wants everything to be the biggest and the best ever. He figured out a way for his losing vote total to be the most ever by saying for a sitting president. But there's something significant there as well, because it is so rare for an incumbent president seeking re-election to lose. Would it not have been fair to say that, President Trump was the strong favorite, as unpopular as he was the strong favorite coming into this election?
Well, I don't know if he was the strong favorite coming into the election. I think that any incumbent president should be the strong favorite. He certainly had things on his side, advantages of the incumbency that helped him actually do better in the election than he probably would have if he wasn't. You know, I mean, he was pretty unpopular for a president. We've never seen a president whose approval rating just didn't fluctuate. I mean, it really was very small numbers of people who would go one way or the other for him. He was around 44% of his approval rating. He'd gotten 46% in the election in 2016, and he's right now at 47.7% in this election. So not a whole lot of variation there. Usually you have presidents who go up and down depending on the news. The news did not matter in this presidency, despite all of the seemingly consequential news that there was. So President Trump always had his back up against the wall. He was helped by a strong economy and by the power of the incumbency up until the coronavirus hit. And then his competence in office became a principal issue. It's one that Joe Biden drove home and stuck to that message.
So I think we're seeing that there is some movement at the lectern here. Obviously, speakers are about to get started. They still have masks on, so they're obviously not going to start yet. So let's just see if we can spend a few minutes with White House correspondent Tamara Keith to pick up on some of the things that Domenico and Steve just raised. Tam, are you with us? Welcome.
I am with you.
And so talk about a little bit more about those issues, if you would. What is the president saying right now? Usually there is a concession speech before an acceptance speech. President Trump isn't showing any sign of conceding. What is happening now?
Yeah, there is no indication of a concession speech coming anytime soon. Talking to people who are close to the president, I'm being told it's not over. The public messaging is very much that the fight continues, that 71 million people voted for President Trump, voted for a fighter, and that they want to see this through. However, also in talking to people that are close to the president, there is a sense that it would take something of a miracle for multiple states to suddenly flip in his direction, or for their legal challenges to really change anything at all. But there is this sense that, they can let the legal challenges run their course, and then he's really going to have to, change his messaging.
Have you had a chance to see him today, or has anyone seen him today? And those who have seen him today, often in a day like this when the president doesn't have much of a public schedule, there's a pool of reporters who are allowed to sort of get within viewing range. For those who have seen him today, how does he seem?
So he went golfing today, and he was at the golf course, or arriving at the golf course, just as all of the networks and AP called the race for Joe Biden. The pool reporter writes that his shoulders were slumped as he walked in, but also there's video of him golfing, hitting balls, and seemingly not hitting them into water or sand, or
golfers among us know what you're saying. It's fine. He wasn't having a good day out there is what you're saying.
I'm not saying he was having a bad day on the golf course. There was not there's no indication of that he was having a terrible day on the golf course or anything. He, as we understand it, stopped. There was a wedding at his golf club, and he stopped to take a picture with the bride. He would have driven past both people who were supportive of him, and also people who showed up at his golf course to protest, and people all over the streets of Washington, D.C. as he approached the White House and overpasses and other places where people were expressing their joy that Joe Biden is the president-elect.
I feel obliged to mention that the president was in the past the club champion of numerous golf clubs, including some where it wasn't even clear that he had even played for the club championship. So however he hit the ball today, he may well have come away with what he said was a good score. But setting that aside, Do we understand the president to be at the White House tonight, Tamara, as these thousands of people that we heard earlier were celebrating in the streets and setting off fireworks and hitting a gong and doing other things that might be audible even through all the fencing in the White House?
Absolutely. He is at the White House, and I, based on previous times where there were protests, he is definitely hearing something. It is definitely audible on the White House grounds when that many people are that loud that nearby. Certainly even on the convention night, as there was a go-go band and various protests outside of the president's convention speech, you could hear it on the White House grounds. So he is there. We know that he is there. We are not expecting to see him again tonight, but one can never predict when more tweets might arrive.
Tam, one more question before we turn to others of our colleagues. Do you have any sense of who might be persuasive with the president in asking him to take a more gracious tone, to abide by the law, to be to do what presidents have always done when they have lost re-election, which is to graciously concede and wish their successor well? I mean, we know that for the conservative media, for example, which it tends to be very influential with him, a few people in the conservative media have urged him to graciously accept this moment, but not, certainly not all. Do you have any sense of who might be influential at this moment, who he's listening to?
Certainly Laura Ingraham on Fox News on her show last night laid out a path for him, a path where... And I think that others in his orbit are saying this, too, where he fights the fight. His supporters need to know that he tried absolutely everything. But then that his legacy depends on him conceding gracefully or doing something presidential. If you look at Mick Mulvaney, his former chief of staff, he's written an op-ed in The Wall Street Journal arguing that eventually, when the fight part is over, that President Trump will find a way to exit. And I think that in that tweet that we were referring to, where he talked about winning more votes than ever for a sitting president, you see this starting to take shape. President Trump does not ever admit to being defeated. He finds ways to declare victory. And so he is looking for ways to declare victory. He came out and gave that very strange press conference where he raised a lot of conspiracy theories. But he also said, look, I beat the polls. And by being able to say, I got more votes than any sitting president, he is building the case where he rides off into the sunset, potentially declaring victory.
Now, we're hearing some cheers from Wilmington, Delaware, but not seeing any activity on the stage. Of course, as soon as something happens there, we're going to go directly to Kamala Harris, we expect first, and then Joe Biden. But as we wait, let me bring in NPR's Ron Elving, who has witnessed a lot of Washington history, which is something I want to ask you about. Oh, here comes somebody onto the stage.
That somebody would be the vice president-elect, Kamala Harris.
That is the vice president-elect. You're exactly right. The image is not very good where I am. Yes, waving to the crowd. So we'll expect to hear from her for several minutes, after which we will have an introduction of the president-elect, Joe Biden. We're looking at this video feed of Wilmington, Delaware. Rows of American flags along with blue lights behind, and here is the vice president-elect now at the lectern.
Good evening. Good evening. Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. So, thank you. Good evening. So, Congressman John Lewis, before his passing, wrote, democracy is not a state, it is an act. And what he meant was that America's democracy is not guaranteed. It is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it. To guard it and never take it for granted. And protecting our democracy takes struggle. It takes sacrifice, but there is joy in it, and there is progress, because we, the people, have the power to build a better future. And when our very democracy was on the ballot in this election, with the very soul of America at stake, and the world watching, you ushered in a new day for America. To our campaign staff and volunteers, this extraordinary team, thank you for bringing more people than ever before into the democratic process. And for making this victory possible, to the poll workers and election officials across our country who have worked tirelessly to make sure every vote is counted, our nation owes you a debt of gratitude. You have protected the integrity of our democracy. And to the American people who make up our beautiful country, thank you for turning out in record numbers to make your voices heard. And I know times have been challenging, especially the last several months. The grief, sorrow, and pain, the worries and the struggles. But we have also witnessed your courage, your resilience, and the generosity of your spirit. For 4 years, you marched and organized for equality and justice for our lives and for our planet. And then you voted. And you delivered a clear message. You chose hope and unity, decency, science, and yes, truth. You chose Joe Biden as the next president of the United States of America. And Joe is a healer, a uniter, a tested and steady hand, a person whose own experience of loss gives him a sense of purpose that will help us as a nation reclaim our own sense of purpose, and a man with a big heart who loves with abandon. It's his love for Jill, who will be an incredible First Lady. It's his love for Hunter and Ashley and his grandchildren and the entire Biden family. And while I first knew Joe as vice president, I really got to know him as the father who loved Beau, my dear friend who we remember here today. And to my husband, Doug, and our children, Cole and Ella, and my sister, Maya, and our whole family, I love y'all more than I can ever express. We are so grateful to Joe and Jill for welcoming our family into theirs on this incredible journey. And to the woman most responsible for my presence here today, my mother, Shyamala Gopalan Harris, who is always in our hearts. When she came here from India at the age of 19, she maybe didn't quite imagine this moment, but she believed so deeply in an America where a moment like this is possible. And so I am thinking about her and about the generations of women, black women, Asian, white, Latina, Native American women who throughout our nation's history have paved the way for this moment tonight. women who fought and sacrificed so much for equality and liberty and justice for all, including the black women who are often, too often, overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy.
Harris mentioning women while wearing a white suit, which has often been seen as a symbol of the women's suffrage movement.
Who have worked to secure and protect the right to vote for over a century. 100 years ago with the 19th Amendment, 55 years ago with the Voting Rights Act, and now in 2020 with a new generation of women in our country who cast their ballots and continued the fight for their fundamental right to vote and be heard. Tonight, I reflect on their struggle, their determination, and the strength of their vision to see what can be unburdened by what has been. And I stand on their shoulders. And what a testament it is to Joe's character that he had the audacity to break one of the most substantial barriers that exists in our country and select a woman as his vice president.
You're listening to Vice President-elect Kamala Harris.
But while I may be the first woman in this office, I will not be the last. Because every little girl watching tonight sees that this is a country of possibilities. And to the children of our country, regardless of your gender, our country has sent you a clear message. Dream with ambition, lead with conviction, and see yourselves in a way that others may not, simply because they've never seen it before. But know that we will applaud you every step of the way. And to the American people, no matter who you voted for, I will strive to be a vice president like Joe was to President Obama, loyal, honest, and prepared, waking up every day thinking of you and your family. Because now is when the real work begins, the hard work, the necessary work, the good work, the essential work to save lives and beat this epidemic, to rebuild our economy so it works for working people, to root out systemic racism in our justice system and society, to combat the climate crisis, to unite our country and heal the soul of our nation. And the road ahead will not be easy, but America is ready. And so are Joe and I. We have elected a president who represents the best in us, a leader the world will respect and our children will look up to, a commander-in-chief who will respect our troops and keep our country safe, and a president for all Americans. And it is now my great honor to introduce the president-elect of the United States of America, Joe Biden.
That is Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, the former Attorney General of California, the Senator from California. She will be, upon her swearing in, the first woman to serve as Vice President of the United States, the first Black person to serve as Vice President of the United States, the first woman of South Asian descent, certainly the first person of South Asian descent to serve in this field. She's brought the President-elect, Joe Biden, to the stage They are both wearing their masks. They gave each other a fist bump in deference to the moment, which has now become the protocol in the current global health crisis that we are dealing with.
I feel obliged to mention that the mask regulations in Delaware require you to wear a mask except when public speaking, which is the rule they're following exactly.
And we mentioned that Kamala Harris is wearing a bright white suit as a color of the suffragists. And in fairness, we should mention that Joe Biden is wearing a bright blue tie. And here is President-elect Joe Biden.
Delawareans, I see my buddy, Senator Tom Carper down there, and I think Senator Coons is there, and I think the governor's around. Is that Ruth Ann? And that former Governor Ruth Ann Minner. Most importantly, my sisters-in-law, my sister Valerie. Anyway. Folks, the people of this nation have spoken. They've delivered us a clear victory, a convincing victory, a victory. For we the people, we've won with the most votes ever cast on a presidential ticket in the history of the nation. 74 million. What I must admit has surprised me. Tonight, we're seeing all over this nation, all cities and all parts of the country, indeed across the world, an outpouring of joy, of hope, renewed faith in tomorrow, bring a better day. And I'm humbled by the trust and confidence you've placed in me. I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify. Who doesn't see red states and blue states, only sees the United States. And work with all my heart, with the confidence of the whole people, to win the confidence of all of you. And for that is what America, I believe, is about. It's about people. And that's what our administration will be all about. I sought this office to restore the soul of America, to rebuild the backbone of this nation, the middle class, and to make America respected around the world again. And to unite us here at home. It's the honor of my lifetime that so many millions of Americans have voted for that vision. And now the work of making that vision is real. It's a task, the task of our time. Folks, as I said many times before, I'm Jill's husband. And I would not be here without her love and tireless support of Jill and my son Hunter and Ashley, my daughter, and all our grandchildren and their spouses and all our family. They're my heart. Jill's a mom, a military mom, an educator. And she has dedicated her life to education. But teaching isn't just what she does, it's who she is. For American educators, this is a great day for y'all. You're going to have one of your own in the White House. And Jill's going to make a great first lady. I'm so proud of her. And I'll have the honor of serving with the fantastic vice president who you just heard from, Kamala Harris, who makes history as the first woman, first black woman, the first woman from South Asian descent, the first daughter of an immigrant ever elected in this country. Don't tell me it's not possible in the United States. It's long overdue. And we're reminded tonight of those who fought so hard for so many years to make this happen. But once again, America's bent the arc of the moral universe more toward justice. Kamala, Doug, like it or not, your family, you become an honorary Biden, there's no way out. all those of you who volunteered and worked the polls in the middle of this pandemic, local elected officials, you deserve a special thanks from the entire nation. And to my campaign team and all the volunteers and all who gave so much of themselves to make this moment possible, I owe you. I owe you. I owe you everything. And to all those who supported us, I'm proud of the campaign we built and ran. I'm proud of the coalition we put together, the broadest and most diverse coalition in history. Democrats, Republicans, independents, progressives, moderates, conservatives, young, old, urban, suburban, rural, gay, straight, transgender, white, Latino, Asian, Native American. I mean it, especially those moments, and especially those moments when this campaign was at its lowest ebb, the African-American community stood up again for me. You've always had my back, and I'll have yours. I said at the outset, I wanted to represent this campaign to represent and look like America. We've done that. Now that's what I want the administration to look like and act like. For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies. They are Americans. They are Americans. The Bible tells us to everything there is a season, a time to build, a time to reap, and a time to sow, and a time to heal. This is the time to heal in America. Now this campaign is over. What is the will of the people? What is our mandate? I believe it's this. Americans have called upon us to marshal the forces of decency, the forces of fairness, to marshal the forces of science and the forces of hope in the great battles of our time. The battle to control the virus, the battle to build prosperity, the battle to secure your family's health care, the battle to achieve racial justice and root out systemic racism in this country. And the battle to save our planet by getting climate under control. The battle to restore decency, defend democracy, and give everybody in this country a fair shot. That's all they're asking for, a fair shot. Folks, our work begins with getting COVID under control. We cannot repair the economy, restore our vitality, or relish life's most precious moments, hugging our grandchildren, our children, our birthdays, weddings, graduations, all the moments that matter most to us until we get it under control. On Monday, I will name a group of leading scientists and experts as transition advisors to help take the Biden-Harris COVID plan and convert it into an action blueprint that will start on January the 20th, 2021. That plan will be built on bedrock science. It will be constructed out of compassion, empathy, and concern. I will spare no effort, none, or any commitment to turn around this pandemic. Folks, I'm a proud Democrat, but I will govern as an American president. I'll work as hard for those who didn't vote for me as those who did. Let this grim era of demonization in America begin to end here and now. The refusal of Democrats and Republicans to cooperate with one another. It's not some mysterious force beyond our control. It's a decision, a choice we make. And if we can decide not to cooperate, then we can decide to cooperate. And I believe that this is part of the mandate given to us from the American people. They want us to cooperate in their interest. And that's the choice I'll make. And I'll call on Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, to make that choice with me. The American story is about slow yet steadily widening the opportunities in America. And make no mistake, too many dreams have been deferred for too long. We must make the promise of the country real for everybody, no matter their race, their ethnicity, their faith, their identity, or their disability. Folks, America has always been shaped by inflection points, by moments in time where we've made hard decisions about who we are and what we want to be. Lincoln in 1860, coming to save the Union. FDR in 1932, promising a beleaguered country a new deal. JFK in 1960, pledging a new frontier. And 12 years ago, when Barack Obama made history, he told us, yes, we can. Well, folks, we stand at an inflection point. We have an opportunity to defeat despair, to build a nation of prosperity and purpose. We can do it. I know we can. I've long talked about the battle for the soul of America. We must restore the soul of America. Our nation is shaped by the constant battle between our better angels and our darkest impulses. And what presidents say in this battle matters. It's time for our better angels to prevail. Tonight, the whole world is watching America. And I believe at our best, America is a beacon for the globe. We will not lead. We will lead not only by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. I've always believed, many of you heard me say it, I've always believed we can define America in one word, possibilities. That, in America, everyone should be given an opportunity to go as far as their dreams and God-given ability will take them. You see, I believe in the possibilities of this country. We're always looking ahead. Ahead to an America that's freer and more just. Ahead to an America that creates jobs with dignity and respect. Ahead of America that cures diseases like cancer and Alzheimer's. Ahead to an America that never leaves anyone behind. Ahead of America that never gives up, never gives in. This is a great nation. It's always been a bad bet to bet against America. We're good people. This is the United States of America. And there's never been anything, never been anything we've been able, not able to do when we've done it together. Folks, in the last days of the campaign, I began thinking about a hymn that means a lot to me and my family, particularly my deceased son, Beau. It captures the faith that sustains me, which I believe sustains America. And I hope it can provide some comfort and solace to the 230,000 Americans who've lost a loved one to this terrible virus this year. My heart goes out to each and every one of you. Hopefully this hymn gives you solace as well. And it goes like this. And he will raise you up on eagle's wings, bear you on the breath of dawn, and make you to shine like the sun, and hold you in the palm of his hand. And now together, on eagle's wings, we embark on the work that God and history have called upon us to do. With full hearts and steady hands, with faith in America and in each other, with love of country, a thirst for justice, let us be the nation that we know we can be, a nation united, a nation strengthened, a nation healed, the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen, there's never, never been anything we've tried we've not been able to do. So remember, as my grandpa, our grandpa, he said when I walked out of his home when I was a kid up in Scranton, he said, Joey, keep the faith. And our grandmother, when she was alive, she yelled, no, Joey, spread it. Spread the faith. God love you all. May God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
The car horn's honking as President-elect Biden wraps up a speech to the nation. You are listening to live special coverage from NPR News. In that speech now concluded, the president-elect quoted the Bible, to everything there is a season, and he said, this is a time to heal. Biden said, I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but to unify. He said that being elected by so many millions of people was the honor of my lifetime. He also praised Vice President-elect Harris, the first woman to become president or vice president. And that calls on us to note something historic about Joe Biden. He was the vice president, the running mate of the first black president, and is also now the running mate of the first woman to become vice president, which gives him a unique place in history. No one has ever done that, and by definition, no one else will. And now that Jill Biden has come out onto the stage, the two of them are waving to the crowd. And let's continue our coverage here as we watch the Bidens waving to the crowd. We've got a panel here. NPR's Scott Detrow and Asma Khalid have both been covering the Biden campaign and are with us. Scott and Asma, I'm not sure which of you is with us, but let's go to the first. There, I think that's Asma. Asma, a lot of familiar lines from Joe Biden's speeches there, a lot of things that he's said again and again and again, although in a way that's the point. It's what he wants to say. It's the message he's always wanted to deliver.
Exactly, right? I mean, he spoke about the soul of the nation, which is the very message he's delivered again since he launched his candidacy, this idea of restoring the soul of the nation. But Steve, I thought he did highlight some interesting specific messages. You know, there was a point where he said, I want to speak to those who didn't vote for me, give each other a chance. So some of the rhetoric around unity and how he actually attempts to build cooperation and healing felt new. And part of this is that the context of this is new, right? He may have to work with a Republican Senate, and he needed to deliver some of those messages. He also, though, you know, Steve, spoke more specifically again about the pandemic and how he intends to tackle that immediately. He spoke about the fact that he intends to launch this COVID task force on Monday. He's not waiting to deal with this until inauguration.
I want to pick up on one thing you noticed about let's give each other a chance. He said, I understand disappointment. He spoke, therefore, to President Trump's supporters. I cannot recall a specific line in which he in any way addressed President Trump. Of course, the normal circumstance here would be that the defeated candidate would have conceded, which would create an opening for the winning candidate to say some gracious words about the man he had just defeated. President Trump, of course, is not given that opportunity.
You're right. President Trump has not actually conceded this race. But I will say, by all accounts, you know, Steve, this is a celebration party. You probably hear the fireworks in the background here.
Yeah, keep
people
describing what you see.
Joyous. I was going to say, this is a drive-in car rally, and there are, you know, hundreds of people here, if not thousands, outside of the perimeter. People sitting on top of their cars. The bangs and the pops you hear in the background are fireworks. There was confetti going off. I mean, it had been hard for Biden to actually hold many really in-person events for much of this campaign cycle. So what he's been doing are these driving car rallies, and people here are enthusiastic. You know, I talked to some of them. They were here on Tuesday night expecting to have a party then. That party was delayed and deferred, but they came back for the party tonight.
A big crowd, Asma, it's Michelle, a big crowd on the stage there. Who's up there with them?
You know, I stepped away to the back to be able to talk to you all a bit, but it looks like there's Joe Biden and Jill Biden, much of Joe Biden's family, and also the new vice president-elect Kamala Harris and her family as well.
And her sisters, and looks like some nieces there. It is a very, very, and of course her husband, who will be the first first man to be the spouse of one of the highest elected officials. He's, of course, a Jewish American. A very American tableau here of many races, of all the genders, young and old. Just a very contemporary portrait of America at this moment in our history. So let's go to the rest of our panel now. Our colleagues have all stayed with us through this sort of long day, as it's been many, many long days. And let's go to Scott Detrow now, who's
and
also
before
been
we
covering
do that, if I can just interrupt for a moment here, I'm obliged to just give the briefest break for our stations of just a second or two. So I just want to mention this is special coverage from NPR News. And now we can continue our coverage here. I believe you said Scott Detrow.
So let's go to Scott Detrow now, who's also been covering the Biden campaign. Scott, what did you notice about Mr. Biden's remarks?
In addition to everything Asma said, I want to point out two personal things that struck me. First was just the way that religion permeated what Joe Biden said tonight, quoting Psalms, quoting at the end a Catholic hymn on eagle's wings that you often hear at funerals. He's the second U.S. president to Roman Catholic president after John F. Kennedy. And he every time I traveled with him on Sundays, he would go to church and visit his son Beau's grave before he campaigned for the day. So that's the personal thing on Biden's side. The personal thing on Vice President-elect Kamala Harris's side that really jumped out to me was when she said, "I will be the first woman to serve as vice president, but I will not be the last." When I interviewed her last year, I asked her about the fact that at every event she would take time to talk to young girls who came to campaign with her, really spend time with them, you know, sit down eye to eye, talk to them for minutes at a time. And I asked what her message was. And she would say something that she's often quoted that her mother would drill into her. "Kamala, you may be the first to do something. Make sure you're not the last." Throughout her career, she has broken barriers as the first woman, the first person of color to hold different offices. And now that culminates as the first woman ever elected president or vice president. So for her to say that on that stage and to say, "For every girl watching, this is a country of possibilities," I think that was really striking to a lot of people.
And I'd like to go, I'm going to ask the rest of our panel of colleagues to stand by while I go to another guest. We're pleased to have with us the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, a former competitor of Joe Biden's for the Democratic nomination, Pete Buttigieg, who was a glass ceiling breaker in his own right. He was the first openly LGBTQ person to seek the nomination for the presidency, and he is with us now. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
What are your thoughts about what you heard tonight and what you saw?
Well, what I saw is the president-elect is not wasting any time. He's already commencing what he knows will be a big part of his presidency, which is unifying this country. You saw it, the extraordinary words of outreach to those who voted the other way. You saw in the way he talked about where our country needs to go and how we need to get there together. And I think even in the expression of that faith that is clearly so central to who he is, but I think also one more way he can find common ground and reach out to different Americans. So it was extraordinary to see, not only on the policy stuff, it was striking to me that he was immediately thinking about how even in the transition phase he's going to structure and organize and empower the team that's going to help get ahead of COVID and in his presidency and this pandemic, but also beyond the policy work, just a very broad but I think very powerful call to unity. It was a remarkable thing to see, as was Kamala Harris making history before our eyes and making clear why she will be such a great governing partner to President Biden.
I have one more question for you, though, before I hand you over to my colleague, Steve Inskeep. Is there anything you worry about when you think about what President-elect Joe Biden is about to face? I mean, on the one hand, of course, it was a remarkable showing by the American people, record turnout for both parties, it has to be said, but narrower numbers in the House of Representatives and the Senate sort of still hanging in the balance. So is there anything that concerns you about what it is that he's facing?
Well, what concerns me most is not what he's facing politically, but what we're facing nationally. As he acknowledged in his speech, he'll be taking office under some of the most challenging circumstances any modern president has ever faced on their first day in the White House. The pandemic, the moral crisis in this country over racial and economic injustice, the climate issue reaching emergency proportions, the Democratic legitimacy issues that have really been exacerbated by the last 4 years, and doing it all in a nation that it's also divided. But I think in giving voice to and a very honest acknowledgement of those challenges, while also displaying those qualities that earned him the nomination and now the presidency, I think he helped remind everybody why he's so well suited to that set of challenges that are going to be waiting for him on day one.
And what's it going to take to get people to, what's it going to take to get people to walk away from these conspiracy theories that we've been hearing so much about? And I'm just interested in what you're hearing from your friends and neighbors. You're in Indiana, which is, of course, the home of the current Vice President Mike Pence. And there are people who absolutely are telling us and telling our reporters that they don't accept Joe Biden as their president and Kamala Harris as their vice president. What might it take to change their minds?
Well, I think it began tonight, but it's going to take a huge amount of work. And the biggest thing of all, I believe, is a focus on results. You know, this kind of conspiracy thinking and rhetoric finds less fertile ground when people are experiencing a level of security in their own lives. And the economic inequality and certainly now the broader health emergency we're seeing in this country have really perversely sometimes helped empower cynical politicians who are actually part of the problem. But at the end of the day, you know, this president, as no other president in modern times, will face an absolute imperative to deliver results, to focus on making people's lives better. Because when he does, of course, he will be making better the lives of the people who supported him and the people who did not. And that, I think, over and above saying the right things, is how that unity can be built.
That's the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, who's a contender for the Democratic nomination for the presidency this year himself. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me on.
And now let's return to our correspondents and editors who have watched these two speeches, one by Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, the next by President-elect Joe Biden. And let's go first to Ron Elving, our senior editor and correspondent, who's seen a few of these over the years. And Ron, what stood out to you in the former vice president's remarks, the president-elect's remarks?
I think anyone who has watched a presidential campaign or anyone who has actually run for office and heard one speech over and over or given one speech over and over can imagine a candidate giving that speech for the 14th time in a given day with very few people listening and imagining himself or herself giving that speech in exactly this kind of moment in front of the whole country, having been declared the president-elect. That must be what motivates them, keeps them going on. And tonight, Joe Biden finally got to have that moment after three campaigns for president. I was also struck by the fact that the people watching him are mostly in cars or honking their horns and so on. I can remember when people went to the drive-in for purposes really quite different, and it meant something else entirely to be spending your Saturday night at the drive-in. So this is a kind of a throwback in a funny way to seeing drive-in America again and to see it being a political rally. It is curious. It's obviously another byproduct of the pandemic, but it is something that I think stirs a certain amount of nostalgia, perhaps, and certainly people of Joe Biden's generation or near it. And therefore, I think it is part of his healing process in a very, very small way, a very symbolic way. But I think it does contribute.
I want to remind people that Domenico Montanaro, one of our political editors, is with us. Tamara Keith, our White House correspondent, is still with us. And perhaps you have thoughts about this. We just heard Michelle ask former Mayor Buttigieg about reaching out to the other side, reaching out to the kind of people who voted 57% for Donald Trump in my home state of Indiana, where Mayor Buttigieg is from. And I want to think about this on two different levels when I think about this speech. The first is the cultural signals. We heard Scott Detrow observe how much religion was in that speech, that there were a couple of references to the God, and there was a reference to the Bible. There was a reference to a hymn. That is the one thing that is on my mind. Does he have an approach that can culturally appeal to people who are wildly on the other side of a divide here in America?
Well, certainly, as you say, I think those references to scripture and to a hymn would ring true across any partisan line.
Yes.
Among people who have religion in their lives, and obviously many Trump supporters do have religion in their lives. He's delivered this line many times, but you know, there's the red America, blue America, we're all Americans. I mean, he is at least trying to deliver a message. Now, will this work? I don't know. I mean, if you look at the Twitter feed of Trump World, they're still talking about lawsuits to challenge the results and saying that the media can't decide this, and complaining that as the media talks about what a great speech Joe Biden gave, think about how the media treated Donald Trump all of these years. So I think that there is still a lot of work that he will have to do. And also in talking to Republicans who are going to, in all likelihood, control the Senate and have a larger minority in the House, and who have their eyes on 2022 and 2024 already and are telling me about it, this is not going to be an easy path.
And I want to just mention, obviously, there are millions of people who describe themselves as Christian who are in the Democratic Party. Biden is speaking very overtly about his faith in a way that the politicians from neither party necessarily do. And it has a particular resonance across party lines. Let me ask Domenico Montanaro briefly about substance. Whatever cultural signals he tries to send, isn't Joe Biden in a position where he's going to come into office and want to immediately do something about the pandemic, immediately do something about climate, issues that are essentially about science but have been wildly politicized?
You know, these speeches have to be authentic, right? And we know that Joe Biden is of the social justice wing of Catholicism. So him going and talking about religion is not necessarily a reach out to the other side, but I'm sure the campaign was saying, well, it's not so bad if you appear to be a religious person. And I think that does inform his empathy and his humanity. And I was struck by the fact that, you know, he had a clear structure to this speech. He talked about, essentially, I won. He gave praise and thanks to his allies. He reached out to those who didn't vote for him, called for calm. And then there's the practical piece of the work that needed to be done, which you're talking about here, the substance, standing up a coronavirus task force, thinking about how to deal with the economy. We're going to be in an interesting situation here over the next, 70 days or so, where we have a president of the United States, still elected president, who's not necessarily accepting the results of this election, pushing through the court systems, trying to find whatever avenue he can, unless something changes, which I wouldn't bet on. And then you have sort of a shadow president who's filling in a shadow cabinet. And we're in the middle of a crisis. We were in a crisis in 2008, different kind of crisis, an economic crisis, but we had much more, it was a much more smooth process. There was much more fluidity. The Bush administration worked hand in glove with the incoming Obama administration, despite their differences. That's not necessarily going to happen here.
Okay, let's bring another voice into the conversation now. Ed Rollins is a veteran Republican political consultant. He's run many campaigns over the decades. And if I'm not mistaken, he also ran a pro-President Trump political action committee in recent years. Mr. Rollins, welcome.
That's correct. I also served as the assistant of the president for President Reagan and worked for Nixon, Ford.
So I've You've got about as much experience as anybody could. From your perspective, what did you think of the vice president's speech and the way that he tried to reach out to the other side?
I think it's a very positive thing. As I watched this today, I love the transition, peaceful transition. Obviously, I'm on another side. I have a different philosophy. But this is a man who obviously walks into the White House with more experience than anybody in modern times. He's replacing someone who had less experience. The team that President Biden will put together won't be strangers to the White House, won't be strangers to the task. They'll walk in on day one. They'll be familiar names. And again, I contrast that with President Trump, who obviously had spent little time in Washington, was not a part of that process, which was some of the appeal. And the people that he bought in were all brand new. Many of them had never even been in the White House. On day one, they will start with massive, massive task ahead. But I think what I appreciated today, and as I watched the oldest man to serve in the presidency, and there's been, he'll be the 45th man to be president, the young people in the streets today across this country, the joyous celebration, this will be their first president. There'll be excitement about his presidency, as there was with Obama, as there was with Reagan, as it was with Trump. But the task ahead is massive. And again, I didn't think he would ever win. I've watched him over the years lose presidencies. Mm-hmm. But this is a persistence. But I think the most important thing is he's a man of experience. He's a man who basically will know how to know the levels of government.
And one from one of the live mics in Wilmington, I think we're hearing some of the cheering that's continuing there. I want to ask you about the president that you supported for re-election, Mr. Rollins. As you know, the president is insisting on fighting this legally, even though we know of no evidence of any particular meaningful fraud at this time. If he called you up, what advice would you give President Trump?
My advice would be, if you have any evidence, move it forth in the courts. If you don't have any evidence, get into your transition to leave office. The way he behaves the next 2 months here will basically be a big part of his legacy. And I watched the passage of presidencies before, and it's one of the great joys of America is that we do it peacefully. So my sense is, if you have legal challenges, go make them. But at the end of the day, I think it's over. I think this president has won a tremendous victory. Probably 75, 76 million people voted for him. And I think to a certain extent, he gets the opportunity to move forward. And I always feel it's very important to support a president, whoever he may be, and to pray for him. I've been in the Oval Office for a couple of presidents. I know what a task it is ahead. Mm-hmm. And I wish him well for the good of the country.
Ed Rollins, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
As we come down to our last few minutes of coverage on this historic day, I just want to spend a few more minutes with Ron Elving, who's our NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron Elving, this election season has exposed some very deep divisions in this country. What concerns you most? And then, of course, I'm going to ask you, what gives you the most hope when you think about everything we've learned about the country and seen of the country this year?
One big question in what you just asked is, did this election expose deep divisions, or did this election in some sense or another deepen divisions? Did it in some sense or another make them worse? And sometimes elections can do that. They can divide people, make people take their own sides, make people villainize and demonize even their opposition. One of the things that I am most concerned about is the degree to which we are mainstreaming certain kinds of conspiracy theory that in not too distant past were simply ruled out, simply not considered seriously, not really even talked about. But social media has changed the equation, and now, of course, things like QAnon actually get discussed and treated with some seriousness by elected officials such as President Trump. So that concerns me a great deal. What gives me some degree of hope is the number of people who seem to have recognized exactly what I'm talking about and seem to have recognized how campaigns are contributing to divisions. In the end, campaigns can do that, but campaigns can also resolve at the end if people can rally around the winners. And in this case, the winners include people from both parties. Obviously, Joe Biden's a Democrat, but this was a good election for Republicans on all other levels. And so rallying around the winners is a bipartisan proposition and something that could actually produce some hope going forward.
And what about today? Is there something, what struck you most about today? We saw an awful lot today. We saw the president, we heard from the president through his favored mechanism, tweeting. We heard a number of other people from his party say that he should step aside gracefully. And then we heard these two speeches from the Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, and history maker, and President-elect Joe Biden. What struck you the most today, as briefly as you can?
It was saddening that the president chose not to concede, but I don't think anyone was surprised. He has pretty much painted himself into a corner on that and insisted the election isn't legitimate and that he wants to go on fighting in court in other ways. So it's very difficult for him to concede. I think he's going to wish, not too far down the road, that he had done it and done it sooner. That is the American tradition. It goes way back, way, way back, and has been honored, and sometimes honored quite gallantly, by losing candidates. I'm thinking of John McCain here. I'm thinking of Al Gore back in 2000. It can make a big difference to making things better after the election.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. I want to thank him, and I want to thank all of our colleagues who supported and led our coverage today. Those you heard on the mic, those you cannot see, but we very much know are behind us, behind the mic, behind the glass, in the control room, all over the building. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News. Thank you for being with us on this historic day. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Stay tuned to your NPR station for much more coverage in the days ahead. This has been special coverage from NPR News.